Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Investor Ray Dalio says the biggest mistake investors make is believing that what happened in the recent past is likely to persist. That's quite the pearl of wisdom. I'm Jimmy Weah. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Coming up on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at results out of Libstar and the Old Mutual Group. We're going to speak to both the company CEOs and get a sense of how each company fared respectively. We're also going to have a conversation with the team at Standard Bank and take a look at the gender conversation where it relates to investing and investment management. We're going to see what we make of that. Then we have a conversation with the team at Turlov Family Office Securities around a new investment platform they are bringing to market. Before we wrap up the show with a property conversation, taking a look at the performance of the rental market in 2025.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual, we kick off with a sense of market movements throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, to take a look at market movements and see what we make of them. Nick, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A better day on markets today. It's only the second day of the week, though we know that a lot could still happen. But coming out of the weekend, the expectation was that things like the oil price would be north of $105. We haven't yet breached that level this week. What do you make of today's movements?
Yeah, evening, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on. Evening to the listeners. Better day on the bourse, I guess. I mean, we were down a little bit in the first couple of hours of trade, and then spent the better half of the second half of the day sort of rallying up, finishing up about 0.6%. And yeah, just to your point, you know, coming in this morning, Asian markets were far better. We had Nvidia kicking off their once a year conference as well, and that went reasonably well as well. So tech was back in favor. And all those together led to a bit of a risk on scenario. And also, just to end on your point as well, you know, oil, you know, back at, I guess, you know, West Texas at 95, not 100. You know, it's only $5, but psychologically, the fact that it's under 100, I guess, also led to a little bit of a risk on day. So better all round today.
Nick, what seems to be moving around in the equity space? I see there aren't too many moving parts from an equity perspective other than results and potentially some of the sentiment around those results. But European markets had a really good day. They were up more than 1% where other markets may have lagged. What was their secret today?
Yeah, I think it's very much that risk on risk off scenario. When you're getting that, the last week certainly that risk off, you're getting a stronger dollar that was hitting the commodities, and the euro is on the back foot, and that sentiment sort of flowing back into U.S. assets. And I guess a day like today, you know, it's sort of a positive impetus to start with. The euro getting a little bit of a bit as well, and you know, that just generally fed into that European. But it really is a switch between, you know, good days in Europe and bad days in Europe to good days in the US and bad days in the US. So we're all following this oil price really at the end of the day.
It doesn't sound like there's a lot of certainty at the moment, Nick. I mean, an on-off situation doesn't bode well for investment decisions. I suppose if you're a day trader, you're loving the volatility. But the moment you're looking to make more longer-term or more thought-through decisions, I notice that we're seemingly in on Monday, out by Friday.
Yeah, it's very uncertain. Everyone's trying to find their edge, Jimmy, and trying to figure out, you know, where this goes, how it ends. I mean, I found myself today looking at real-time feeds of shipping lanes in the Straits of Hormuz, and I never thought it would be part of my investment thesis, but you know, everyone's an oil expert at the moment. But that's where we are. I mean, everything right now is literally hinging on that commodity complex and the ability to move goods through the Straits of Hormuz. You know, is it open? Is it shut? Until we get some sort of indication, we really are. So it's a bit of a guessing game, Jimmy.
Nick, how do we filter the information that comes out of the Middle East at the moment? There's been a lot of speculation around whether or not the Iranians have said that the strait is open to everybody except the United States. There have been claims that everybody has to now transact in Chinese yuan as opposed to US dollars. Now, we don't know from a truth perspective how reliable some of these statements are. How do you sift through that as an investor, and how does that affect your positions within the market if you're looking to take any?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it's a bit of a, cliche, but, you've got to look at the valuations, you've got to stick to your plans. I think we chatted last time, you stick to your long-term plans and try and filter out the noise as hard as it is. I mean, as I said, just a second ago, ultimately everything is hinging on what happens with this oil price right now. So if you can learn to try and not focus just on that, and then you can certainly rebalance portfolios accordingly. You've seen the last week, for example, a little bit of money going into the tech space. That seems to be a little bit, I guess, sort of out the realm of what's happening in the commodity complex with oil and the like, and all US dollar denominated assets are a little bit of a question mark over. So the tech space is getting a little bit of flows now. But in general, Jimmy, I don't really have a definitive answer. It's really tricky out there with managing money.
Nick, let's take a look at the performance of currencies. They also reflective at the moment of what the uncertainty looks like in the market. I mean, the Rand back at 16 Rand 70 almost. At one stage, you and I were having conversations below 16 Rand. We know that a lot of this has to do with that risk-off sentiment as risk leaves emerging markets, and South Africa being a proxy for that emerging market currency trade. What do you make of the performance of the Rand, not just against the US dollar, but perhaps against all of the major currencies?
Yeah, so the currency is now, hinging on certainly on the back of that, what the dollar is doing, and not just the dollar, what the central banks are doing. Right now, there's so much other stuff going on besides what's happening in Iran. It's quite a rare occurrence. We're getting four major central banks that are setting interest rates this week. The big, we've got obviously the Bank of Japan, ECB, Bank of England, the Fed announced tomorrow. This morning we had Bank of Australia that actually raised rates. And we've also got Sweden, Switzerland. There's quite a few, I could carry on naming them. But all these central banks now, just a couple of months ago, Jimmy, we're talking about interest rate cuts. Maybe not right this session now, but certainly sort of June, July, going into the second half of the year, we're talking about 2-3 interest rate cuts from these central banks. Such as the inflation fear sort of popped up now. We're now talking about interest rate rises. And off the back of that, money going back into the dollar, into the sort of, the sort of developed markets, which has put emerging markets literally under the cosh. I mean, look at this rand. I mean, it's moved literally almost a rand in the space of 2 weeks. It's a bit depressing. All that sort of decent, hard work that we did as a country last year can be, wiped out with things outside of our control for now.
Nick, let's stick with that central bank conversation. Your expectations around the interest rates, obviously, as you mentioned, inflation likely to fuel the decision-making process from a committee perspective, the committees and those responsible for those interest rate decisions set to meet and set to make or set to consider that. How do we think the US's decision is going to play out? And by extension, I suppose, how do we think that then sets the tone for other central banks to look at markets? I mean, you touched on the Australian central bank already taking the lead in interest rate decisions from their perspective. And at some point, we were going through conversations looking at central banks making the best decisions for their own economies. I suppose this is a global problem, and so this might cause a global inflationary problem.
Big time. That is your major risk here, is that beneath all these other moves, inflation risk, I guess, now has been marked up quite a bit. And then the other side of inflation has been marked up by this I guess, fear of higher energy prices. You're getting growth expectations now being marked down. And, any central banker, that's like the absolute nightmare. I mean, then you start talking about stagflation, which is a real problem. I mean, I think it's far too early to call that yet. But the longer that this oil price does what it does and stays close to 100 or over 100, the likelihood of higher inflation persists. But I must say, that in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. The world's lived with higher oil prices before. The problem you've got to look out for is if you get a real sort of oil shock. We all can in a few days' time, all of a sudden oil's at 150. Then you've got that typically, these huge spikes is what actually leads to market sell-offs and I guess ultimately heightened recession risks. But I will say we're not there yet. We're still trying to figure out how this is going to end.
Nick, let's scenario play that oil conversation out in a bit. You touched on 150, and that is an alarming number. Mm-hmm. I know we recently got very close to the $120 level on Brent, but what does 150 look like? What does that mean for global markets? What does that mean? I mean, there's analysts out there saying that that triggers a massive sell-off, tips us into potentially recessionary environments if that inflation persists and those prices persist. What does a world where Brent is at 150 look like for markets?
Well, very troubled unless you, I guess you're sitting in Texas on an oil. the rest of us will suffer immensely. I mean, a real oil spike, just shoots your sort of recession risk straight up. I mean, then you're talking about a recession. Because the whole world revolves on, look, we're not the same, we're not like we were in the 1970s. We have sort of deviated a little bit to alternative energy sources. But still, the world still does run on a majority of oil. The Southeast Asian countries, likes of India, China would take a huge knock as well. I mean, they import almost all that oil from the Middle East. I guess things like America would be a little bit more sheltered, but it does get passed on through the entire chain, the food chain, the transport, the goods, all fertilizers, everything else would the costs would go up exponentially. So, it doesn't even bear thinking about it. If we get to 150 oil, then we've really got a problem. But as I say, it's not the base case. And I just to add, I've always said this on the show a few times, markets are fairly efficient. And the front end, the spot price of oil might be near 100. But the further out you look down the sort of the futures markets, you get what's called backwardation, where they are forecasting a price of oil closer to 70 the further you get out, $60 if you look at January next year. So for now, the base case, certainly what the front end of the oil market is saying, is that this is going to be, short-lived. I say that 3 weeks in, but that is the base case for now.
Well, when you say short-lived, I'm reminded of the time President Trump said it was done in a day. And 3 weeks later, here we are. Nick, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on the gold price. Is that base case looking good, looking bad? I mean, it's still dipping below the $5,000 an ounce mark every now and then. Doesn't seem to be moving too much at the moment with all the risk sentiment and the uncertainty. But again, having run up from $3,000 to $5,000 almost effortlessly, one can forgive it for taking a bit of a breather.
Yeah, I think the price action is behaving reasonably well. I mean, 4996 as we speak on spot gold. So, $3, $4 short of that 5,000 level. Look, I think, those who want to have a little bit of insurance, I think gold at these levels certainly is possibly some. I think the recent sell-off in gold also, that dollar index is what's pushed this gold price down where it was. I mean, it's back over 100 at one stage. It's back under 100 on the dollar index. So yeah, I think gold, you could probably take a look at these current levels. Certainly has a little bit of insurance.
Insurance might be needed if the markets continue to behave the way they have been behaving, but even then, tread lightly and tread carefully. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, for joining us to take a look at markets and try and make sense of them.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Libstar Holdings Limited, the business responsible for bringing you brands like the Goldcrest Honey, Lancewood Cottage Cheese, and even the Amagwinya that we find in Woolworths recently as today released their results for the financial year ended 31 December 2025. A stellar set of numbers from a business that continues to grow. Revenue growth of 8.2%. Gross profit margins up 22%. For more on this, I'm joined on the line by the company's Chief Executive Officer, Charles de Villiers, to take a look at their performance and see what we make of it. Charles, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A strong year for the business with all of the moving parts and transactions that you had to go through, and we'll get into those transactions in a moment. Take us through your thoughts on what the year brought and how you navigated it.
Thanks for your time. I think overall quite a pleasing set of results, as you mentioned, with both the ambient products super category and the perishables super category showing decent revenue growth, volume growth and margin expansion. That was certainly a highlight for us. Also, a highlight on the cash generation and balance sheet was the increase in our cash conversion rate, as well as a reduction in gearing, which really gives us a lot of optionality looking forward.
Charles, we'll take a look at the outlook from a business perspective in a bit. I want to get a sense of operationally some of the decisions you had to contend with throughout the year. Obviously, the big decision, the standout decision, was that decision to sell off the Denny Mushrooms business that you previously owned. That coming through just before the end of this financial year, around December 1st, was the finalization of that transaction. Take us through the rationale there and what that now means for the business.
When we set out on this strategy in 2023, we gave the strategy three pillars, and that was simplification of the operating model, but also of the portfolio itself. So within that simplification theme, we took a look at some of the businesses within the business that were either subscale or were potentially a drag on performance or capital allocation. Denny had been structurally underperforming for a number of years, and we took the difficult decision to exit that business, which was then also duly completed in December of last year. We retained the Versantekraal facility, which is simply a farm, and we'll look to exit that in the coming months. And as a result of that, showing a higher EBITDA margin and profitability from the portfolio as a whole, albeit from a difficult decision to sell the business.
Charles, let's take a look at some of the other areas of the business. The business isn't only made up of one portfolio asset. You have brands that you bring in, international brands. You have private label brands. You have Libstar specific brands as well. Take us through perhaps the performance across the segments and what the business really appreciated about having such a broadened portfolio.
You know, we speak about a portfolio of businesses which delivers brand solutions. So if you take a look at our own brands, our leading brand is that of Lancewood, which grew its market share by 0.6 percentage points in the dairy category and by 1% in the yogurt category, which was a particularly pleasing outcome for a market leader, a brand such as Lancewood. If you then move to our principal brands, you mentioned international brands. We onboarded a number of new brands from General Mills, and that was successfully integrated into the portfolio and added a decent contribution to revenue and margin performance for the year. And then lastly, we view private label as an important part of our product basket, and particularly in the wet condiments subcategory, we delivered growth exceeding that of the market within our sources, both private label and own branded.
Charles, let's talk about the investor side of the business. The business announcing two important decisions moving forward, the share buyback and the relaxation of the dividend policy. Take us through the strategic thinking behind that and what that now means for investors and for the business going forward.
It's really important to us that we do what we can to enhance stakeholder value, and there are three pillars to that approach. Firstly, the reinvestment in our own capabilities and efficiencies, and we'll talk to that at our upcoming Capital Markets Day. But as you mentioned, two other pillars being the relaxation of our dividend policy and an increase in our dividend per share of more than 86% year on year, and then also a repurchase program which was launched today of up to 5% of total shares in issue to show our belief in the intrinsic value of the portfolio and the trajectory that we are on.
Charles, you mentioned at the start of the conversation that the business had been focused on cleaning up some of the aspects of the balance sheet as part of your strategy and moving forward with that strategy. What does that look like going into the new financial year? What areas of the business are you going to be focusing on in greater detail? And how are you seeing the markets that you're operating in?
So our simplification, growth and sustainability strategy remains firmly in place. In terms of the simplification pillar, there's still some work to be done in terms of our geographic integration of some facilities. We'll be integrating one of our largest sauce factories into Montague Foods, and that will drive further efficiencies in the category, and doing a similar exercise in dry condiments. On the growth front, really looking to target our underrepresented channels, both in food service, continued growth in retail through own branded and private label, and then also looking at targeted exports, which remains an important growth pillar for us. And then in terms of sustainability, retaining the balance sheet optionality and flexibility whilst returning capital to shareholders responsibly.
Maintaining shareholder responsibilities, but also ensuring that South Africans have their fair fill of Tabasco. The team at Libstar Group having a stellar financial year and looking forward to the new financial year. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the company's Chief Executive Officer, Charles de Villiers, for joining us to take a look at the year that was.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We are taking a look at the importance of having the right kinds of investors in the investment landscape. And sometimes that right kind of investor comes in the form of a female-owned asset manager or fund manager investing in a female-led business. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the program manager for the African Women Impact Fund at Standard Bank, Toby Lefinga. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Toby, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start our conversation with the importance of having investors look at investments from a gender perspective. We don't often see this come up in the financial world and in the investment landscape, but let's start the conversation with the importance of thinking about this.
Thank you, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners, and thank you for having me. So if you look at South Africa as a landscape, we've made some significant progress when it comes to gender equality, particularly from a legal and political representation. But when you look at, you know, the lived experiences of women, you know, the economic exclusion and labor inequality still persist. And what you then have is that a majority of women who are working age only own about 22% of SMEs in South Africa. And the issue there really is that traditional funding models do not cater for women SMEs. And so you find that women are highly concentrated in micro and informal businesses, even though, you know, there's research that shows out there that they are able to generate, you know, more profit than male-led enterprises. And so the importance really of looking at women fund managers as investors and asset allocators is that you want more women making those investment decisions, because you cannot talk about the prosperity of a country while ignoring, you know, the role of half of the population in driving our economy, because this is essential in driving inclusive growth and the overall sustainability and development of our country.
Tobile, what are some of the specific challenges that present themselves when we think about the financial services and financial landscape that might predominantly potentially affect women more than they affect men, or perhaps present themselves more in these sorts of conversations?
Thanks, Jimmy. I think a lot has to do with where we come from as a country. A lot of structural barriers do persist for women given their role in society. And so the biggest challenge really is access to funding. And if you look at traditional funding models, if you yourself approach a bank, there are certain things that are required from you, such as collateral and assets to put up against a loan. And it's really as simple as that, that a lot of women do not possess these assets that will allow them to access the finance. A lot of women do not possess networks, you know, within their own community that have that funding that will provide them with the necessary funding. So a lot of women don't have the necessary markets and the skills for their enterprise development. And really what then happens is while there are a lot of women entrepreneurs who are starting out, they have a challenge in growing and scaling their businesses to get out of that informal sector. And you find that a lot of the times, and this is not just in South Africa, but across the continent, women are heavily entrenched within the informal sector, doing, you know, playing in the fields such as trade, personal care and hygiene. And you don't really get that progression from a small enterprise all the way to a medium and enterprise sectors.
Tobile, let's take a look at the importance or the role that fund managers play, and by extension, financial institutions like Standard Bank in this ecosystem. It's important to think about businesses, as you mentioned, at all levels, not just the larger corporations, but also not just the small startups. Take us through why having female-led asset managers and asset allocators then enhances the ecosystem for female entrepreneurs to build businesses.
So what I just spoke to is just the clear, you know, structural barriers that do exist. And in order for us to avoid reinforcing this, there must be some deliberate and targeted interventions that directly expand women's participation by improving women's access to finance. As I've mentioned, that's one of the most key, you know, gaps that do exist. And what we've seen from our own experiences and what research tells you is that women fund managers are twice as likely to invest in women enterprises. So when you support a woman fund manager, you do foster opportunities for investments to flow to woman-owned and woman-led enterprises. And so you need initiatives that are designed to be gender responsive in channeling, you know, the necessary funding that will then translate to broad-based economic opportunity. And that's what we see in a lot of the women fund managers who understand the realities and the lived experiences of women SMEs and are able to then provide tailored and more patient capital to women SMEs. And I think in a more practical sense, if you walk into a big boardroom and there's someone who looks like you that is in the boardroom, it does oftentimes allows and builds confidence in the women SMEs as well. So representation is a big, you know, gap that exists in the investment world. And having more women as fund managers and allocators really does balance the scale for a lot of the women SMEs.
Empowerment comes in many different forms, and if we are to truly move things forward as a country and as an economy, we need to think about all of the participants in that ecosystem and ensuring that everybody receives the support that they need. I think we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Program Director for the African Women Impact Fund at Standard Bank, Tobile Finga, for joining us to take a look at supporting female entrepreneurs and female asset managers.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Investing today means thinking beyond borders. This interview is brought to you by T-Force, an authorized financial services provider. If you're looking for investment services out there, there is a new party on the block in the form of T-Force. The business has officially opened its doors to South African customers, is licensed in South Africa, and is looking to provide you with investment and trading solutions that might be beneficial to you. I'm joined on the line by the Regional Business Development Lead for South Africa at T-Force, Chris Vermark, to take a look at their business and get a better understanding of it. Chris, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about T-Force. Tell us about the business and why it is that this business is important in the day and age that we live in South Africa.
Thanks, Jimmy. It's a privilege, obviously, to be on SAFM, especially as a long-time listener myself. So T4 has come to the industry to essentially be a stock brokerage servicing offer next-generation platform. So what we do is we focus on giving investors easy access to global markets that would fall from your New York Stock Exchange, your London Stock Exchange, your Hong Kong Stock Exchange. And importantly, what we do is we give access to direct access retail shares. So what that means is we're not a CFD provider. You own the actual asset when you purchase it. And yeah, so we a whole host of products that we offer, from shares, bonds, ETFs, and digital assets. And that's us in a nutshell.
Chris, what makes T-Force different to other service providers? From a business perspective, there are stockbroking companies out there. There are trading platforms out there. There are investment platforms out there. How does T-Force differentiate themselves in the market? And what is it that you guys do so well?
So what differentiates from the rest of the industry, I would say, is our focus on the educational portion of investing. So we have a section on our platform that specifically looks at ideas in the market. So if analyst team has write up articles on the different stocks, ETFs, and they just give a little bit more information rather than you having to kind of look at the whole market and say, what should I invest in? They just give these ideas. Obviously, it's educational. It's not advice by any means, but that kind of sets us apart, as well as not being a CFD provider. Yeah, like we mentioned briefly in our discussion before this, there is a place for that, but we look at the long-term discipline investor that really drives for long-term returns.
Now, Chris, you mentioned that the platform does not offer advisory-related services, but I do know that you do have room for advisors who want to be part of the platform and offer their services into the market. Take us through some of the product offering that is available in that respect.
Yeah, so we obviously open to essentially everyone to invest on our platform. So from your retail DIY investor to your actual independent financial advisors, and as well as asset managers. So essentially, as an advisor coming onto our platform, we offer the infrastructure for them to invest on behalf of their client. So they'll have a login detail that they'll go in and as an advisor, they'll onboard their client with us, and then they'll be able to stock pick or ETF pick or even look at bonds for their clients. And it's all to do with, obviously, they'll be able to look at what their client's needs are and then determine on that, then they'll do the investments on behalf of their client.
Chris, you touched on the importance of education, and that's a cornerstone of the T-Force offering. Can we take a look at some of the other initiatives that come with the T-Force platform? I know you guys are involved in investment forums and hosting specific events to help clients on their investment journeys. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so we currently associate sponsors with the Collaborative Exchange, and they host a whole bunch of different financial events, one being the investment forum, the biggest one in South Africa, where advisors and asset managers meet. So we're trying to come to market with these institutions, which are already doing great work. The other thing that we're also doing is we have local events in our office where we will host your advisors as well as asset managers just to have that collaboration and talk about relevant topics in the investment world and also showcase a little bit of what we can offer different advisors or asset managers just to spark interest in themselves.
The team at Turlov Family Office Securities, T-Force, are officially letting us know that they are open and able to take on a new business through their investment and trading platform. Reach out to them if you are looking for investment, even if you're just looking for a bit of guidance around some of the educational content that they're able to provide. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Chris Vermaak, the Regional Business Development Lead for South Africa at T-Force, for joining us to take a look at their business. This interview was brought to you by T-Force, connecting investors to global markets with integrity. Visit tforce.com. T-Force is an authorized financial services provider. In a connected world, investors need access beyond borders. T-Force is a South African company connecting investors and financial advisors to global markets through a regulated investment platform. Trade international equities, ETFs, bonds, crypto, and more, all while maintaining transparency and control. Access global opportunities with confidence. Visit tforce.com. T-Force. Global markets, institutional access. T-Force is an authorized financial services provider.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
The Property Pod.
We go global and also focus on the tourism sector on the Property Pod's latest episode this week on MoneyWeb. The Skift Megatrends event took place in Africa for the first time last week in Cape Town atop Table Mountain. Sandton-based hotel investors The Malat Group brought the event to South Africa. On the podcast, we speak to Malat Group founder and CEO Hamza Faruqi to share insights on the event, its investment plans, and what's holding tourism in SA and Africa back.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights. SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As we were reflecting on markets a little earlier on, I had a look at the price of silver having briefly gone above the $80 fine ounce level. That not having the best time, back below $80 a fine ounce there. It seems as though the commodity prices continue to be volatile, and whether or not that will continue to unfold is something that markets will have to make sense of. But as we speak of those commodity prices, a quick look at the Brent crude price. That's currently sitting around $99, maybe $99.50 a barrel. Interestingly enough, today having got, or rather this month, having gone as high as that $119 level. So markets are seemingly still trying to make sense of what's going on here and are trying to figure out what it is that we can take from this. But that is where we are at the moment from an equity point of view, or from a commodity point of view rather, and that is what seems to be concerning investors, as you heard earlier when I spoke to Nick Kunz. He had some insights around that. If we have a look at the equities markets, local in the form of the top 40, that seemingly struggling along as well. At some point, we were above 120,000 points on the top 40. We're back at around 110,000, just below that, struggling to get back above that. I suppose the risk in the market is that if we do continue to see these escalating tensions and they don't resolve themselves, then we have a different set of problems that we have to contend with. And those sets of problems not looking like they're going to be clearing up anytime soon. So unfortunately for market participants, if you're worried and you're trying to figure out where to hide in this market dilemma, I don't think I have the answer for you. I do, however, have a quick look at the US dollar index, and that is sitting still below 100 points. It briefly tapped above 100 points, is struggling to get back above there. Clearly, markets are not convinced that the US dollar is all the way there as a safe haven. Perhaps that has something to do with what is happening in the White House. Perhaps that has something to do with how markets are reading the global geopolitical concerns. But I think if we are sitting where we are at the moment, if we do happen to break above this level from a dollar index perspective, then it looks as though we could go back towards February of 2025 levels, up to the 110 almost points mark. So that's what's happening on the markets front. That's what's happening in terms of some of the market movement. What we are going to get into now, though, is the latest from the team at the Old Mutual Group. They provided us with an update on the performance of the company for the year that was. Joined on the line by the Chief Executive Officer at Old Mutual Group, Yuri Stradom, to take a look at the performance and see what to make of it. Yuri, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A mixed set of updates from an annual perspective, but at a group level, the group doing exceptionally well, increasing from a revenue and a growth perspective. How did you find the year?
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. Good to be with you. I think we classified as a sort of steady operating performance. Results from operations up 13%, adjusted headline earnings up 24%, and that's the sort of big earnings metric that we tend to reference. Of course, cautioning that significantly supported, like all of our peers, by market or financial market performance. Pleased with an 8% our dividend. Our shareholders, I think, we will be pleased with an 8% increase in the dividend. And then importantly, the group equity value, which is the sort of value that we place on the business, up to 19.80 per share.
Speaking of value, Yuri, let's take a look at some of the updates within the business. The Old Mutual Bank business, perhaps you can give us an update on that. We saw that the carrying value of that had to be impaired under IAS 36 by half of what we had initially had it there. Give us a sense of what's happening in that business, what's the reason and the rationale behind the impairment, and just perhaps how that business is coming along.
So we're actually very comfortable, Jimmy, with the performance of the business. You know, we went live with the business in September last year. We've got significant customer traction. You know, we're still signing up 3,000 customers a day. The deposit book is built nicely. And you know, the whole proposition around that business is actually its integration with our existing Old Mutual distribution and bricks and mortar infrastructure. And so, you know, almost half the customers actually signed up through our Old Mutual Finance branches. So, you know, this is a year of significant execution in that business. It's not just about acquiring customers, but it's obviously also about, you know, transaction activity, credit extension, and the like. And of course, the integration of mutual rewards, which is also proving a significant catalyst. I think the point of the impairment was a sort of a technical matter. If you look through to the group equity value that we reference, you know, then you know, that kind of reflects the value that we place on the bank in the context of the overall value of Old Mutual, and you know, and that quoted that number I quoted you of 19.80 per share.
Yuri, the business that is the Old Mutual Group over the more than century that it has been around has built up many different parts to it in the form of the insurance business, the life business, now the banking business and the other operating entities. Take us through perhaps the standout performers from a divisional perspective, if any, and how, or if there are any divisions that might have you a bit worried at this stage.
Well, you know, so I think it is a portfolio of businesses, Jim, as you say. So there's always, you know, different cycles. I think we'd call out the Old Mutual Insure business in this year with an underwriting, normalized underwriting margin of 8.3%, which we were very pleased with. And we think that business now really is a platform that we've turned around operationally. We think it's at the cutting edge in many ways of claims management and of actuarial pricing, the use of data and AI. So you know, we're very comfortable with that as a growth platform going forward.
Yuri, let's take a look at the buyback. The buyback being announced towards the latter part of 2025, September, so a 3 billion rand share buyback there. How's that moving along from a business perspective?
Yeah, so we'd executed 700 million of that by the end of December. As of yesterday, that's 1.3 billion. And so we're 1.3 billion through the 3 billion that we've set up. That program will carry on for the rest of the year. We execute according to where the share price is relative to group equity value. And so, you know, that it's got to be value accretive for shareholders as we execute.
Yuri, let's take a look at the board changes that have been announced or that are said to be coming into effect. We know we've got a chair designate with the current chair in the form of Trevor Manuel set to step down. We know that there's a new Old Mutual Insure CEO coming into the fold. Take us through some of the corporate and board adjustments and how they will impact the business's management.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously the big news is the announcement of the chair designate in Roger Jardine. Roger joined the board in September, and so we've been working with him since then. But of course, he comes with extraordinary credentials and track record for his time, both as a chief executive and as a non-exec and chairman at some of South Africa's leading companies. So, yeah, we're really delighted. Of course, very big shoes to fill. Trevor Manuel, I've had the great privilege of working with him as a non-exec first, and then as chief executive. So certainly there'll be a time to pay tribute to his kind of indelible impact that he's made on the group over the last decade. But it has been an extraordinary impact.
Yuri, let's look ahead to the new financial year, the business finally getting over the hurdles well in time, of course, with that Old Mutual Bank launch. I imagine that would have taken a bit of resource to get over the line and get all the relevant licensing in place. That is done. The business is on good footing there. Other business units are performing well. How are you approaching the new year from a strategic point of view, and what are you looking forward to?
So, you know, Jimmy, obviously last year I came in as Group Chief Executive midway through last year. In the second half of last year, we really had that strategic reset. And we set ourselves five really important medium-term targets, which is 3 to 5 year targets, on the most important measures in our group. And so, you know, 2026 really is the first year of really moving from where we are to where we need to be in terms of those targets. So it's a year of execution. It's a year of the management team putting runs on the board on those key measures.
executing and making sure that runs get on the board from an Old Mutual perspective, a business that has been in South African lives for well over a century, having a good year and hoping that that will continue. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Group Chief Executive Officer, Yuri Stradom, for joining us to take a look at the year that was, the year that ended December 31, 2025.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's time for Property Tuesday. It's time for us to reflect on the property markets in some way, shape or form. Today we're looking specifically at the rental markets and how they have fared in 2025. I'm joined on the line by the commercial director at PayProp South Africa, Michelle Dickens, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Michelle, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. The rental markets have, over the years, performed quite differently to the buying and selling side of property. And we know that rental demand tends to be a lot more seasonal and perhaps more dynamic than the long-term property investment space. How did it fare in 2025?
So I think property fared quite nicely. Property investments, the tenant behavior, the buy-to-let market, it all fared really well in 2025. We had interest rate cuts, and that always helps. It helps in a number of different areas. As you mentioned, on the selling side, you've got better buyer sentiment, better first-time home buyers, and definitely buyer sentiment in terms of people wanting to invest in buy-to-let markets. With interest rates coming down, we also see an improvement in tenant behavior. So we tend to see better affordability, and tenants have more disposable income, which helps in terms of what they're attracted to rent. Basically, the year ended on a good note. We've had, starting off maybe 18 months ago, we peaked at rental escalations of 6%. We've stayed fairly high above inflation, so real returns for the whole year. Slowly coming down to ending in December at 4.5% average national rental growth, which is still not bad. In real terms, we're still positive. Different parts of the regions faring better. Western Cape has outperformed, but has slowly started to come down and kind of come back to normalize with the rest of the national average. We finished the year off in all but the best performance in terms of tenant collections. So we had the second lowest on record number of tenants that are in arrears, and the lowest value in terms of those tenants that are in arrears. How much are they in arrears by? We saw that sitting at the lowest value. So to give some numbers to that, 17% of tenants ended in December with some level of arrears on their accounts, and the average value of those arrears was 71% of a calculation of rent to what their arrears were. So that's come down substantially from kind of, when you give context to that, the pandemic period, we were above 100%. So it's been coming down nicely over the last 5 years.
Michelle, you mentioned the buy-to-let market growing in a bit of popularity and a bit of strength from a market perspective. Does that mean that investments into investment properties are still continuing to follow the trends that we've been seeing? We know that a lot of interest is taken in the form of Airbnbs and perhaps just putting properties out onto the rental market. Is that a sign that there's still interest in perhaps buying those assets, not to stay in, but to generate income from?
Absolutely. I mean, if we were to look at, for example, our partner in banking, PayProp is a payment processing platform. We're a fintech company. We process rental to the tune of, in December, 1.7 billion rands worth of rent just in the December market. And our banking partner in this is Absa Bank. So if we were to look at the home buyer sentiments from Absa Bank in quarter four of last year, not only was the buying sentiment the best it's ever been, joint best it's ever been, but the investor sentiment was also joint top of what it's been in the past on record. And so that speaks to a sentiment of people saying, yes, I'm interested in the buy-to-let market. Does it result in purchases of buy-to-let? Yes, we've seen a result in that as well. You've mentioned, though, Airbnb in the short-term market, and I do believe that people acquire a taste for either purchasing for Airbnb or for purchasing for investment for long-term. We do often see people ending up in I'm an investor, I'm a landlord by default because I have a primary residence, I've moved up or I've moved on or I've migrated, and therefore my residence I'm going to put on the rental market. That's not someone going into the market from a buy-to-let investor or from an Airbnb investor. And I do believe the properties that attract either one of those two types of residential investment, the type of property will dictate where those people either go long-term or short-term. So I personally don't believe that a lot of what would be long-term rentals end up in the buy-to-let market, and therefore Western Cape would be an example, or, for example, your coastal areas where there's a lot of Airbnb on the market. I don't believe that takes off your investment buy-to-let market.
Michelle, what has tenants concerned and what has landlords concerned at this stage in the rental space?
Well, the main concern for tenants is safety and security, low-maintenance property, costs, absolutely. Not just the cost of the property, but the costs of the additional charges, utilities, water, electricity, parking, refuse, sewerage, all the additional costs that get added on. So having a very clear understanding of what the final value is of the rental invoice at the end of the month is really, really important, and being able to keep manage those costs going forward. From a landlord perspective, the things that keep landlords awake at night is the quality of the tenant that's being placed and the ability to collect rent timelessly and get it back into the hands of the landlord as quickly as possible. And the other things that affect the market as a whole from the estate agent perspective, from a rental market perspective, is being able to attract landlords and grow portfolios and ensure that these portfolios remain profitable. So from a landlord's perspective, where we see rental growth still nice and a little bit above what inflation is at the moment, landlords feel less pressure. But as soon as we see that switch where our rental growth dips below what inflation is, the cost of holding the property becomes more expensive, and our ability to increase the rent in line with that doesn't quite meet. And so that's when landlords start to feel a little bit of a pinch from a financial perspective. And that's when we see landlords sometimes wanting to say, oh, maybe I'll go and DIY my own property myself. And being too close to a tenant, you know, sometimes tenants can take advantage of this from a landlord perspective.
Michelle, before I let you go, looking ahead into 2026, do you expect certain rental trends to continue from a market perspective and from a performance perspective? And do we expect that the rental market will grow into this year?
Absolutely. The rental market, by its very nature, as we've seen a slowdown in property transactions, and as we've seen that the average age of a first-time home buyer has leapt up to 38, that by its very nature means that our tenant market remains strong with strong demand. And so where we have a market with strong demand, we just have to ensure that we keep up with supply in terms of new builds coming onto the market. And if we can keep up with supply, we'll have a very strong market going forward. I think the aspects that will be key to determine the strength of the tenants would be interest rates. If we have some more interest rate cuts, that would, of course, improve tenant affordability, and tenants would have access to a wider variety of properties. As we start to see interest rates go up, though, then we start to see a change in behavior. Budgets become a little tighter. Disposable income becomes a little tighter. And we start to see default rates going up. So it's key critical at this stage to ensure that affordability is one of the key metrics that our investors are paying close attention to in the placement of tenants right now. Because in 12 months' time, whichever way those interest rates go, it'll have an effect on their behavior.
The rental market for 2025 certainly had a robust year from a performance perspective, and 2026 now suddenly becoming a little less certain, but still boding well for renters and landlords alike. I think we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Michelle for those insights and for the time. Michelle Dickens, the commercial director at PayProp South Africa, joining us to take a look at the rental market in 2025 and what it might look like this year.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the update for today, folks. It is coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by the top sport team. So from my side, good night.